I read a book that blew my mind just now. There's a couple of books.
See, you're doing it already.
So we've only been talking for about 30 seconds and a beautiful quote came out.
Es Devlin, welcome to Visionaries.
Best set design. Es Devlin for the never.
I am a stage designer and also an artist. I've been designing for theatre and opera and fashion and pop concerts for Beyoncé, Adele. And I also make solo installation work as well.
Can you remember the first time you saw your work at massive scale? We're talking the Beyoncé concerts that you've done. How did you feel?
The first time I remember having that, it's bigger than I made it, was actually the very first project I made.
While Ez's canvas varies, she's always known for crafting breathtaking, thought-provoking, immersive experiences.
I call my work stage sculpture. We're a bit like pilots navigating a flight path for 100,000 passengers.
You've spoken so powerfully about the audience and you're serving them with every work. Most people are looking at the stage and you might be looking at the audience.
The intelligence of a gathered group of people, the potential for shifting of perspective and possibly change. You know, the question I get asked all the time when I do a talk is, how do you retain your sense of self, especially when you're collaborating with celebrated people? I didn't go into it to retain a sense of self. I went in to see through the eyes of another. If anything, to lose a sense of self.
You described your work as a series of projects seeing through the lens of others. 120 projects. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
It's a sort of diagnostic series of ways of seeing.
What would you say to the young people who are inspired by your path and can't seem to find their own way?
Walk away from the rooms that you don't like. If you don't like the room, try and change it if you can. But if you can't change it, then find another room with other people.
You don't just see photos, you feel. And that's what you should be armed with before you even hold a camera.
You kind of disappear down that lens and you're in another world.
A quick note before we dive in. This episode is brought to you in partnership with MPB, who make it easy for storytellers to buy, trade, or sell camera equipment. I've used them myself as a sustainable choice for purchasing kit, like this Nikon FM2. I really recommend checking them out at mpb.com. Es Devlin, welcome to Visionaries.
Thank you for that gorgeous introduction.
Es, you're so, every time I see you, you're so grounded, you're so humble, and yet you have the conviction and self-assurance, and I admire it so much. What puts you out of your comfort zone? Are there things that still scare you with everything that you've done? Are there commissions that come your way? Are there ideas that you come up with that push you to your own edge?
I mean, I'm really crap at sport. I live with a family who are really sporty.
Really?
If you throw anything at me, I will duck.
And that scares me.
I can't carry my hand to eye coordination. If I try and, like, you saw me with that, but if I try and carry my helmet and a bag and a phone, then I would just stand there, like, paralyzed. If I die tomorrow, which I really hope I don't, but if I did, what it would have to say on my grave was, she did a lot, it was all good, but she didn't dance enough. I think we should all dance more, right? I think that could be on many people's gravestones, right?
Yeah.
We spend too much time on the computer, not time dancing. But I think, in terms of answering your question about being out of the comfort zone, you get to a point where you have an instinct straight away of what to do. I used to question myself much more when I was younger. I used to a lot of the time go, oh, this is my first idea, I better have a different one, or maybe it's wrong. And now I really don't. I go, okay, this is the idea, we're doing that. Maybe I should be more uncomfortable about things. But I feel time is short, man. You know, I read the Steve Jobs, very moving, Steve Jobs emails to himself. Steve Jobs was adopted and very aware of the sacrifices his parents made, because they'd promised his birth mother, who was a college student, that they would send him to college. And they didn't have the money to, really, but they did. They made sacrifices in a big way. And he would look in the mirror from the age of 17 every morning and say to himself, if this was my last day, would I be happy with how I've spent it? And he did that all his life, by all accounts. And if he went sort of 5 days in a row where the answer was no, then he made a change. So yeah, I tend to maneuver myself into a situation of comfort where I can do.
I'd seen in an interview that you said that I'm aware of how short and precious life is. Mm. And I was curious to ask you why. You know, just before we spoke, your parents are luckily still with us. Do you know why you have that sense that life is short and precious and to be held onto? Because it's something that many of us can lose sight of.
I've made this myth about myself. It might not be true, but it might be because my earliest memory is nearly drowning. My parents keep saying you mustn't be able to remember it, but there's no photographs of it. So I don't know how I remember these images. I think I was 2 or 3. And I was paddling with my tiny brother and my dad in the River Thames, in Kingston upon Thames, where I grew up. And the one thing my mum said to my dad when he took us out was, whatever you do, don't let them paddle in the river. And we, of course, paddled in the river. And there's no photographs of me doing this, but I remember what I looked like. I remember the little stepping stones. I remember the whole thing. And I remember the water. I remember being under the water. I remember it was kind of grayish, greenish. There were little bits of rock, little bits of seaweedy stuff. It was kind of gritty. And there was a light coming through. I remember what it looked like. And I don't remember kind of panic or fear. I just, now I interpret it as remembering that this is different. This is a medium other than air. But I may be overlaying that now. But also probably my biggest memory must have been someone saved me. I was saved. You know, my dad immediately scooped me up. But I wouldn't go near the water after that. I wouldn't swim.
You don't remember experiencing fear.
No.
But you remember light.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because one of your most famous quotes is you sometimes need to start without light to find it. So I wonder if in that moment the influence of light becomes some kind of thread in your work.
It may be, and you know what? It makes sense to me. You know, my family kind of laugh at me. They say, oh, you know, my dad goes, oh, you're always going on about that. It wasn't that bad. I'm like, but actually it helps me to make sense of myself. Of course. And if it's my own little myth about myself that helps me make sense of myself, then I recommend everybody do that. You know, everybody thread your necklace of moments together to make sense of yourself.
That's why I go to therapy.
Well, then you'd be more, then you're more useful.
So I have this with me.
Yes, good.
Your book, your first monograph.
Yeah.
And I immediately noticed when I got it that it's shaped like an aperture lens. And when I did some digging about that, I saw that you described your work as a series of projects seeing through the lens of others. And I love that. And I thought it was a great point of departure of this conversation. Because for me, visionaries are people who really see others, invoke empathy through their work. And I know that that's what you do. So tell me about this book, 900 pages, 120 projects. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
Well, you know, when you go to the optician, it may be now that the machine is more technically advanced, but in the old days, the optometrist would put a lens in front of your eye and he'd say, how does the world look through that? And you'd say, oh, it's okay. And then they add another one. Is this better or worse? Better or worse? And then they add another lens like that. And it's a sort of diagnostic series of ways of seeing. And I guess the reason why the book is a series of overlapping irises at the beginning is a reflection of that practice. But also inscribed on those overlapping irises is the name of everybody I've ever worked with, ever. And that includes my ancestors. That includes the books I've read that have been seminal to my thinking. And it's a sort of cosmology in the vein of Jorge Luis Borges when he said, I do not believe that I exist, actually. I am the sum total of every book I've ever read, everyone I've ever loved, every road I've ever walked down, every mountain I've ever climbed up, every river I've ever swum in.
See, you're doing it already.
So
we've only been talking for about 30 seconds and a beautiful quote came out.
It was a way for me to thread myself together because over 30 years, the practice has been branching. I read a book called A Necklace of Raindrops when I was a child by Joan Aitken. And it was a fairy tale, but it was a way to thread myself together and find the through line that conjoined a line of inquiry through all these branching works.
What has been that line of inquiry? Because I guess the power of being able to see from another person's perspective, which is how you describe that, is to, and I heard you describe it like this, un-other other people. And how important is that to you? Is that a through line that you've seen? Is it one that become or has become more important? It feels to me that we're in more divided times than we've been. How important is it that we use art to un-other and to deeply see others?
When I began making choices, there was no clarity. You know, I can look back now. But the choices I made at the time were based on how I felt in the rooms I walked in. Mm. If I walked into a room and it smelt slightly feral and people had stayed up all night and there might be a little mouse, someone had been eating a pot noodle all night and there was opera playing and people were talking about a play and making little model theatres, I wanted to stay in that room. And I made a lot of the decisions early on based on, do I feel good in this place with these people? As simple as that. And if I felt good about the place and the people I stayed, and if I didn't, I moved on.
Was that instinct? Would you describe it as instinct?
I guess so. I think it's just understanding that you can think with the pores of your skin and with the hairs on your arms and with the undersides of your feet. All of these things are thinking. I didn't know that at the time, but that's probably what I was doing. And then I guess now, looking back, perhaps the instinct to make theatre, which was the first sort of real choice I made. I had a place at Central St. Martin's after I'd finished the foundation course to do an art degree. I'd already done an English degree, so I was a little long in my education. And I had that place and I walked into the room where I would have been for 3 years. And it was a beautiful white room. And then I walked into this other feral room. And I just thought, I'm not ready for the white room yet. I don't feel I have enough to say. I don't feel I want to be on my own. And that was an important choice. I wanted to make work with others. And I think I didn't want to enter into the market of work. You know, it was the time of the young British artists, an exciting time of art in London in the 90s. But I didn't quite understand the idea of making things a number of times to sell some of them. I didn't piece it all together. So I kind of wandered into a situation where there is no client. That relationship doesn't exist. It's the audience and the makers of the work, and the work is the boss, if you know what I mean.
And how were those early years? You went to CSM, you then went on to do a degree, but then you ended up at the Bush Theatre. Creative limitations, the size of the space. I mean, how was it back then in those early years to make work?
It was feral. It was sellotape and string, badges, posters, stickers and t-shirts. It was up all night, nails, you know, in your mouth while you were looking for the gaffer tape. It was a time when it was hard to make films, I think. So there were quite a few writers who had kind of, I guess, written films, but decided in the meantime to put them on in the theatre. So you would have a play which might have been written with the bedroom, then the bus, then the park, then a hospital. And so you couldn't do a naturalistic kind of environment because it had to flow. So that was a great training for me. And it all had to happen in a room that was, you know, maybe 4 meters wide by 7 meters wide and about 3 meters tall, with 75 people sitting in a circle watching, with very high expectations and some really good actors.
You mentioned this word client, and it's funny because my research before today, I was thinking about that. You've spoken so powerfully about the audience and you're serving them with every work. You've described sometimes, you know, you find most people are looking at the stage and you might be looking at the audience. So who are you serving with your work?
In my studio, we're quite careful on our vocabulary. I'm afraid the word client is banned.
Is it?
I didn't come across that word until 2016, and I'd been practicing already since 1996. So for 20 years, no one said the word client to me. You don't say it in theatre because you're not really being paid. You get paid a modest amount, but you're being paid, I guess, by a theatre company. A lot of it is state subsidised, so it's part of a, you know, system of tax and subsidy. There's definitely a hierarchy in theatre. You are working below the director, who will say what they want it to be, and the playwright, if they're living. But they're not paying you. They're not your client. They're the director. They're your collaborator, who is hierarchically above you. So the first time I heard the word, it was in 2016, and I had misread an email. The email, when I looked at it later, had probably said something like, "Do you want to do a piece of experiential marketing for a perfume?" But I really didn't understand that. I thought it said, would you like to do your first major sculptural art installation? And we'll pay. That's what I genuinely thought it said. That I wanted it to say that. But midway into that process, the conversation was happening, and there was something that the person paying for it didn't like, and the producer said, the client wants this. I was like, oh. So that's how that word shows up.
Mm-hmm.
That word shows up when there's a difference of opinion and the person paying is in charge. I'd never heard it in 20 years of practice. So I thought, well, how do we not do that? How do we not use that word? How do we just say, okay, what's the name of the person?
Mm.
What are their requirements and needs? Because every collaborator has different needs from a collaboration. So we break it down like that.
Take me into your world then. How do these projects come to you? How do you work with your collaborators?
I mean, I guess at the beginning, for the first couple of decades, my career path was pretty straight. I was a theatre designer doing my thing. Then I started in 2003. Someone asked me, would you do a pop concert? And I did it at the Barbican Theatre. It was the last ever show of a band called Wire.
How did you feel when you got that offer?
I thought it'd be interesting to unpick the anatomy of this band. And I thought that pop concerts were a bit messy. I found they were this kind of wobbly shape of the drummer was always on this little stand to get his face at the same height. And there was all this mess, and tangle, and cables, and that was messy. So I thought, I'm going to clean it up. So I put these poor unsuspecting four members of a band in four boxes, which is very standard now, but it wasn't then. And then I put a gauze on the front and a rear projection screen on the back, and I wired them up to an ECG reading machine so that we could monitor their heartbeat on the front projection. And I wanted to put them in MRI scan, but that was obviously complicated and beyond my £2,000 budget. The whole point was to somewhat create a portrait of this band. So projected the bassist's eye, the drummer's nose, the singer's mouth, the guitarist's eye. And we stapled this thing all together because we couldn't afford Velcro, which meant at the end they couldn't come out to take a bow. But it was still good. So that was the first one.
And were they on board? How did they feel when you came along and started to monitor their heartbeat?
I mean, they were very game. The drummers fell off, so he flatlined. But I don't think anyone minded. So it started like that, and then it went on to a lot then of concerts.
Yeah.
And then that led to all sorts of things. So in the beginning, it was like that. And then now it's really about having sort of identified a bit more this line of inquiry, which is a question you asked me was, what is it? And I guess it is seeking of porosity. Porosity between self and other in terms of species and biosphere and humans, and porosity between self and other in terms of humans and other humans. And I think also an understanding of the species of the audience. I believe that the audience is a very intelligent species. When human beings sit together and decide to focus on something, put their distractions away for a minute, they will know instantly when something is true or false, I think. I didn't know that when I went into theatre, but I think that's what I've learned. So the intelligence of a gathered group of people, the potential, not only for porosity, but for shifting of perspective and possibly change.
When I met you, it was at the UN Climate Conference. You had just finished making this incredible installation, Forest for Change. Was it Forest for Change or Conference of the Trees?
That was Conference of the Trees.
So it was around 120 trees. Can you share your thinking behind that project and why there and why it was so significant?
I had read The Overstory, Richard Powers. It was so instructive to read a chunk of a book. The first sort of third is seen really solely from the perspective of the trees. And as a human, you're forced to shift your sense of time passing. You have to adjust the calibration of how you view time to keep up or keep down with the speed that a tree perceives time. And I thought, well, if we're having this conference of the parties, could we invite the trees to it to observe and witness anything that we might be doing at this conference? So we selected a tree to equate with each party. It was quite special in there.
And it was such a brilliant contrast to the conference itself, which is famously terribly lit, unbelievably bad food. It's kind of devoid of oxygen, sort of physically and spiritually almost. And so to come to where you'd done the installation was incredible. And I'll never forget that you spoke on stage and you spoke about awe, to be awe-inspired and the power of awe. And I've been thinking about that a lot at the moment, because particularly when it comes to climate and talking about nature, it feels that the creative challenge is sort of bigger than ever, to find ways to Trojan horse these stories into creativity, into art, into storytelling in general, because people feel, I think, in a way more disempowered than they ever have. They're wanting to turn a blind eye. We're overwhelmed. I think we're more sensitive to being preached to. Do you feel that the awe that you create with your work, the beauty, is a kind of Trojan horse?
I think I learned that from Timothy Morton, who was in conversation with Hans Ulrich Obrist at the Serpentine, and he reached a place of real grief in the conversation. I think he was weeping. I think Hans Ulrich said to him, "What should artists do?" And I think he said, "Please, please don't preach. Preaching kind of got us here. Please don't preach. Please amaze us into changing our minds." So that really resonated with me.
And do you think it's possible? Does that amazement create a sense of change? And do you think it can change things at a systemic level?
A combination of art and magic, because I've been working with magic and illusion, but without knowing why. And I think it's because it's that kind of chink in the armor, that destabilizing of certainty. If we could just kind of get a chink through the barricade of people's certainties.
When I met you, you'd done Conference of the Trees for us, The Change. You did an amazing installation last year, Congregation, all with very powerful messages. What do you see your role to be?
I'm trying to be very anchored with my feet in the clay of where I am. So I've made quite a lot of work, which is just learning where I am. Who am I in London? And who are Londoners? That's been the work of Congregation that you mentioned, which was 50 portraits of those who bring their gifts to London. And I needed to learn who I was in relation to the porosity I felt of our community towards Ukraine, which I hadn't experienced in my life, that kind of national porosity. Growing up in the 1980s under Thatcher, there wasn't that before where we were welcoming. And yet, in parallel, the brittleness of the discourse around invasions on beaches, stop the boats, when it came to people coming from Somalia or Afghanistan or Congo. And I wanted to understand that dissonance. Why? And I thought, well, if it's in my community, the first place I need to look is in me, because it's probably in me. I need to find it. I need to catch it. So I wanted to find my own unconscious biases. And that was what I was doing in that project, was drawing without speaking and trying to meet people just through their faces who had experienced displacement, who'd come to London as refugees, bringing gifts, and to stare into someone's eyes for 45 minutes and try humbly to leave traces of that encounter in chalk and charcoal. When it's not what I normally do. I haven't spent 30 years making portraits. So I didn't want to, you know, get it wrong. I didn't want to offend. I caught myself at all sorts of mental, you know, lunacy, trying to do it right. And I learned a lot about myself and about how to mitigate my own unconscious biases.
Must have been so powerful to be so up close. There's a phrase I love, and I always wish that I remember who said it, but it's that prejudice doesn't survive proximity. There were experiments done around just the simple act of being in front of someone and holding eye contact with them, in emotionally connecting and to letting go of prejudice. And they did that, I remember, around the refugee crisis years ago, but so powerful. And I didn't know this theme also about London, because I remember Coming Home Again was also the species that were on the conservation list. So species that are at risk of being lost from London. I travel very far. I get on the plane and go, but you're being inspired by what's around you.
Come Home Again was a couple of years before Congregation, and it was an invitation, a very simple invitation, which was, will you make a portrait of Londoners? Actually, well, not even a portrait, make a piece about Londoners. And at the time, I asked, well, could I make it about Londoners who are more than human? And first I needed to find out how many are there, because I didn't know that there are 15,000 species of Londoner, of which human happens to only be one.
Love that. Londoners who are more than human.
And that's so not brilliant. Even including all the Londoners who live inside each human.
Mm.
So there's another kajillion that I didn't even include. I want to do that next, actually. What I really want to do next, I want to draw my own bones. Well, I just did this residency at MIT, and they did an fMRI scan. And so I met my own brain. It was so exciting.
What's an fMRI scan?
It's a functional MRI scan. It means that you are functioning while they do it. So they give you really hard, like, tasks. I was really struggling tasks of maths and sort of nonverbal reasoning things that I was kind of panicking at. But they want to see which parts of your brain are doing stuff.
Right.
So I had that.
Were there any clues to why your brain is so extraordinary? Was it over-functioning in certain areas? Mean, what did you learn?
I don't think it was anything extraordinary. I think it was just extraordinary for me to witness the geometry, geography, and architecture of what's inside my mind. And I just read recently about an artist who spent quite a lot of time drawing anatomy, you know, drawing bones. And I would really love, having drawn my city, I actually want to go in to myself more and draw the bones. And I'd love to draw the creatures, you know, or the microbiome. I read a book that blew my mind just now, which is called My Stroke of Insight.
Mm.
It's by a neuroanatomist called Jill Bolte Taylor. She's done a pretty famous TED talk in 2008 about it. She had a left hemisphere brain stroke.
Mm.
And because she's a neuroanatomist, she was aware that she was having a left brain hemisphere stroke. She was able to document it.
Wow.
And she observed that when the left hemisphere was down, she attended to the world only with the right hemisphere. And she felt an absolute continuity with the world. And there's a couple of books, one called The Master and His Emissary and the other called The Matter with Things. They're both by Professor Ian McGilchrist. His point of view is that he sees a lot of the disequilibrium that we live through as a result of the disequilibrium between the modes of attention of our right and left hemispheres in our brain.
Interesting.
And he takes it back to when we were nematode worms 700 million years ago. We already had the beginning of separated bipartite brains. His suggestion, and it seems to be pretty uncontroversial, is that the left hemisphere was specialist in separation, and largely to identify food, to find out from what you are perceiving what is food. And the right hemisphere was specialist in big picture, the horizon, to resist becoming food.
Mm.
So one half of your brain is trying to not be eaten. The other one's trying to eat. That makes sense, right? But as you go through evolution, that gets us to separation, identification, language, all of that stuff. And then on the right hemisphere, it's much more continuity, porosity, empathy, all of that. And it's not that the two halves of the brain do different things. They all do everything, it seems, but they do it with a different mode of attention. So Jill Bolte Taylor knew all this. And so she experienced this bliss.
Mm.
While she was having a stroke, her book and her TED talk are really about trying to encourage practices which try to recalibrate the equilibrium between mode of attention of right and left hemisphere. Because the theory is that really, for a couple of millennia, we've been gradually prioritizing through language, through the use of language, perhaps. We've been prioritizing the mode of attention of the left hemisphere.
Where does psychedelics fit into that?
Probably by tuning the left one down and tuning
and
up
quietening the,
right one.
The left and tuning.
Yeah, probably. I don't know enough about it. We have to look into it.
You speak about the interconnectedness of things. You speak about the more than human, and it sort of seems obvious to you and implicit in your work. But I wonder where it comes from, because that idea of humans and nature being separate, when really humans are a part of nature and not apart from it. I mean, when did you learn that to be a truth? Because everything about the society in which we live, you mentioned separation, has been built. Modern civilization has been built to separate us. The story that we're separate from nature is such an insidious one. Was there a turning point, an awakening moment where you realized that A, it wasn't true, but B, that you wanted your work to focus on revealing a different story?
I mean, I think my reading, I read a lot. And I think my
You read a lot. It's surprised to me, given how many authors you've mentioned in the past few minutes.
My reading teaches me stuff to a degree.
Yeah.
But then the practice. I mean, that's why, you know, I love the Joanna Macy, World is Love, a World of Self, because it's got the exercises at the back. You can practice. But when I read in Joanna's book, now we can relinquish our separation. We can come home again to our mutual belonging. I read that. And I practice her exercises at the back of the book. But then for me, the sustained meditation of 4 months of drawing more than human Londoners, 243 of them, 60 bats, 32 moths, 52 birds, some snakes, some rabbits, some plants. What happened there is I also got very tired because I was trying to cram it in. I'd run out of time. I had to get it all done. And very late one night, I checked my email and Hans Ulrich Obrist, who's my dear colleague at the Serpentine, said, listen, we've held the printing of this poster that you promised you would do for our Back to Earth exhibition, and you're the only one who hasn't delivered. You need to get it to us by the morning. I was like, okay. So I put my hand on the table and I drew around my hand. I was really tired. I wasn't really thinking. I just did it. And then I cut out the animals I'd been drawing and stuck them on. And I made this gesture of continuity between the geometry in my hand and the geometry of these animals. And I felt continuous because I was practicing, because I was drawing it.
Does it make a difference for you what scale you're working at? Because you've worked at different scales. You're mentioning the intricacies within our bones, within our lungs. Of course, you've worked on huge theatre productions, but also set designs. How does that scale shape the work that you make?
I don't know why I like doing really big things. I guess I'm really interested in edges of things. Our brain, I think, is a great edge detector. You know, pretty much all the information that we piece together is about the edges, I think. So I'm really interested in the human form in relation to the parameters that surround it. And I think that may be why I was interested in theatre. Literally, at a very basic level, walking into a room where people were putting small human figures in these square frames of a theatre box. And I wanted to mess with that instinctively. I wanted to put more pressure and say, well, what happens if the frame is tight around the human? And what happens if the human is giant? You know, and I guess the thing about scale, when you look at a model of a house or a theatre, I defy you to introduce me to a human who doesn't go, wow. Humans love models, right?
Yeah.
And I think they love them because two things happen. I think when you look at a scale model, at once you feel like a child, like you could fit in it. You transpose yourself and you feel small and you have that sense of what it was like when you were small. At the same time, you feel giant and you can see the system. You can perceive the system. Like when you look down on a maze or a map, you can find your way, whereas when you're lost in it, you can't. So this holding at once two modes of being, of being able to see the whole system and being tiny and lost in the system, that's the art of being human, I think, or being conscious, or being left brain, right brain. That is the art of it. That's what we are. So I'm really interested in both scales. I'm not that good at medium size.
You go super small or very big. Can you remember the first time you saw your work at a massive scale? We're talking the Beyoncé concerts that you've done. Do you remember the first time? How did you feel? Were you so preoccupied with how the audience were feeling? Are you absorbing the atmosphere? How was it for you? Take me back to that moment.
The first time I remember having that, it's bigger than I made it, was actually the very first project I made in 1996 at the Bolton Octagon Theatre.
Wow.
I'd been making little models probably most of my life, and I'd done this intense one-year theatre course, and I'd won this prize, and the prize was a job in Bolton. And I'd made this staircase. I'd been like sweating over this staircase. It was my prize-winning model. I'd been carving it and making these little tiles. Every little, I was so like.
But the scale is tiny at this
point. The scale, it was one. It was 25 times smaller. At, wow. You know, when you're doing that, that's for a theatre. You do it 1 to 25. Once you get into stadium, you might do 1 to 500 or 1 to 1,000. But this is 1 to 25. And I showed up in Bolton to the workshop, and a lovely man called Richard Foxton, who was the resident designer, who took me under his wing. Because I knew nothing. He said, right, we're going to come in and we're going to see your staircase. It's been built. It was a wall and a staircase and a shower. It was a whole piece of set. And I smelt these angle grinders. You know, it was the smell of a workshop of a bunch of people making stuff. angle grinders, metal, wood, saw. It was just, I'd never been in a workshop like that.
Did
ever.
You love it?
Oh, I mean, that smell now makes me so happy, I have to say. So I walked in and I just looked at it and it was 25 times bigger. I went, wow, it's amazing. It's fantastic. And after I came out, the very nice guy, Richard Fox, he said, don't you think it was a bit green? I said, you're probably right. I was just so amazed they made it bigger. So that awe of something you make in your hand small, being cared for by others, that was probably the biggest awe.
Visionaries is all about celebrating and supporting storytellers, which is why I'm so excited to be working with NPB, who make it easy to buy, trade, or sell camera gear. I've used NPB myself, not only to buy kit like this Nikon FM2, but to pass on the cameras that I no longer need so that other storytellers can keep creating. It's a really affordable and sustainable way to access the tools that help us to tell the stories that matter. Take a look at npb.com.
The discovery of that room where I could study theatre came at a really crucial moment for me when I wasn't sure what to do. You know, like we all have those moments and I wasn't sure. And I think given the opportunity to work with people in a community like theatre where the work is in charge, I had no idea. I stumbled into it. Had no idea how rare and precious that setup is. Now I still make theatre, but I do lots of other things. But I'm aware that this oddity right now of people gathering together, being quiet for 2 hours and paying attention. This is a great quote from Lindsay Turner, theatre director, when she said, we still the ego for the greater good at exactly 7:30 p.m. The actors agree to pretend that we're not there. We agree to pretend that we're not there. I mean, the oddity that we still do this, right? I still now find it daily ever more precious. But when I embarked on it, I just stumbled into it.
You didn't know. No. It's sort of wonderfully relatable to hear that you did have chapters where you felt feelings of self-doubt, that you didn't know where you were going. It's the kind of thrilling but weirdly frustrating thing about reading people's autobiographies, because it's as if everything just made sense. You know, when we look retrospectively, this just led to this, to that, and they don't mention the sort of couple of years they were desperately trying to find their path, thinking, what the hell am I doing with my life?
If you look at that book, there's a timeline in it. I decided to be encyclopedic, so I put in every single piece of work I've ever did. But what you'll see is everything above the line, there is in the book somehow, that might be a sketch or it might be a photo. All that pale grey stuff below the line, that stuff I didn't think worthy of inclusion. And it's about 50%.
Good. You are mortal. What would you say to the young people who are kind of inspired by your path and can't seem to find their own way?
You know, the question I get asked all the time when I do a talk is, how do you retain your sense of self, especially when you're collaborating with celebrated people? And it took me a while to find what the answer is. And it's actually when I was starting out, and even now, I didn't go into it to retain a sense of self. I went in to see through the eyes of another, if anything, to lose a sense of self. You know, if you're in a conversation like this, we're deciding what the design for that object's going to be in this stadium. I say, I've got a vision, it's going to be this revolving cube, and I'm slightly boring myself already because I've done so many of them. And you go, well, actually, I saw it as a big mushroom, or I saw it as a more organic seaweed type thing. And I go, oh, God, I didn't see that at all. It's going to be hard to do. It's not what I would have thought of. It's the opposite to my instinct. And in the past, I would have been, you know, already machinating how to manipulate this thing back to my point of view. I would have been doing all that. But now I'm like, okay, let's run with that. Let's say it's a seaweed. Let's go. And then you explore and you go, okay, this is not what I would have thought at all, but let's try to find a path towards a common line of inquiry. That's the only thing to do in every, and even when I'm in the back of a cab and the driver says, oh, well, you know, all those people, you know, and you get some really point of view that's not your own. You go, okay, how are we going to find a path here through this conversation? We're going to move to something, we're going to talk about this guy's daughter. We're going to talk about the sport that he likes doing.
Finding common ground.
We're going to find common line of inquiry. There will be one. There always is always one. Is. So I think that's my guidance, really. Look for that in any collaboration. And walk away from the rooms that you don't like. If you don't like the room, try and change it if you can. But if you can't change it, then write a new script for it if you can. Try and, you know, reframe what it is for you, or find another room with other people.
So trust yourself.
If you have a hunch, it's usually right. I try and not get confused between my own paranoia and my hunch. Like, when is it a hunch and when is it just paranoia?
When is it intuition? When is it panic?
Identifying. Is it an instinct, or is it actually a manifestation of your own anxiety? You know, you have to... It could be either a lot of the time, couldn't it?
I mean, I'm the biggest soundboarder. Mm. Do you... You mentioned those advisors, and have you had mentors? Have you had people that you go to when you're not sure that you need to soundboard with? How do you work with those people and help them, let them guide you as well?
My life is constant stream of ongoing conversations. Mm. Lindsay Turner, the director, I've been talking with her. Our conversation started in 2012 and it's still ongoing. Mm. I would say the 8 projects and shows that we've made together are sort of the byproducts, you know, the side products of an ongoing conversation. There are collaborators. I mean, actually, Rupert Gould, who directed the Dear England play, which brought together those who love football but think they hate theatre, and those who love so theatre and thought they weren't interested in football. We first met in 96. So we've been having a conversation for, you know, 30 odd years. So I think, you know, continuity of conversation. Mm. In your work colleagues, in your colleagues, in your friends, in your lovers, whoever they are, I think clutch that, cleave that to you, because if you can have a continuity with people who knew you back then, you know, that rootedness. That's why I really like to be rooted in place.
What else keeps you rooted? I mean, you're very grounded energetically, intellectually, spiritually. Do you have a spiritual practice? Do you have a practice of any kind that keeps you grounded?
Not as such. I wake up in the morning and I do this 20-minute thing where I set the alarm. The architecture has not yet been built of the day. Mm. I see the shadow of it. I know it's going to come, so I feel safe. Mm. But still the fluidity of the mind at night. And I read somewhere, when you sleep, your mind fills with these baths. Mm. They are baths that rejuvenate all of the doings of the mind. And as someone who often stays up late, if there's one thing that will make me go to bed, it's thinking of that bathing of the mind that must happen.
Have you always protected your sleep? I mean, with the amount of work that you've made, people might be mistaken for thinking you don't sleep much, but is that a space that you've always protected?
There was this one moment where I turned to my husband, Jack, and I said, I think I've cracked it. I'm going to do a 48-hour day. And I had stayed up for 48 hours. And I said, this is it. We're just going to forget the 24-hour. I'm going to do 48 hours. And then I'll sleep. And this is going to be game changer. I'll do 2 days awake, and then I'll go to sleep for one night. And then apparently I passed out for 24 hours and it was a catastrophe.
Is that because you can't fall asleep or because you stay up? Like, what is your natural
rhythm?
Oh,
no, I can fall asleep usually. It's because I'm trying to get too much done. But when I was younger, I really could do less sleep. Mm. But now I can't. I need to go to bed. It's better to go to bed.
There's this nebulous... abstract idea, something that I've never seems to slip through my fingertips, but this idea of a work-life balance, is it something that you've been able to find in your life?
Noel Coward said, work is more fun than fun.
That's how I feel. That's how I feel. And people say, no, that's not physically possible, you're a workaholic. I'm like, when it's your mission, your life purpose, I can't tell the difference between work and
no, work is more fun than fun. Fun is hard work.
True.
But I should do more dancing. Sometimes I dance at work.
You've said about your work that very little of it still exists. It exists in the memories of the people that experienced it, in the audience members. And it made me think about legacy. Is legacy something you think about, and what do you want your legacy to be?
Such a great question. I mean, I always think about the origins of words. I think lega is about tying, about bonds, isn't it? Mm. I remember reading on the back of Women in Love, which was one of my favourite books growing up, the D.H. Lawrence. And D.H. Lawrence had a really short biography, and it just said D.H. Lawrence spent most of his short life living. Mm. That sense of what bonds you to those who came before and those who came after. I really think about, can I do justice to the day? Mm. And that if you probably do that, then that stack of days will add up to the best you could have done with the great privilege of being on this planet, you know.
You opened the conversation mentioning your ancestors and how you feel connected to them. So there's some sense. I'm reading at the moment a book called The Good Ancestor.
Oh, yeah, that's a good book. It. Yeah.
And I've always been compelled by the sort of Native American idea around seven generations forward. And yeah. What if we behave today in service to generations to come? And I love that idea of legacy, and it kind of echoes what you're saying about let's be the best that we can today in the present.
And I guess even in spite of everything that we know and that we're pained by, the extraordinary privilege of being alive on this particular planet and being conscious and singing the cosmos back to itself is still beyond a reason to be completely joyous, you know? And it just is, even though there's, of course, grief in it and pain in it. I'm overwhelmed by the joy of it.
It's a miracle.
It is a miracle.
Literally a miracle.
And then, you know, you push a child out and then that's next level as well, so.
Who's a visionary for you and what does that word mean?
Well, it's Joanna Macy. Mm. It's Margaret Atwood. Mm. It's Maya Angelou. It's James Baldwin. It's those who sat and wrote or painted or sang with the clarity of an extended practice of looking and listening and communicating and offering us now these maps, map makers. Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, they leave maps, don't they? Mm. And I guess, you know, I've made an atlas. I'm into maps and cartography. Visionary, meaning being in it enough to have the proprioception and the synesthetic reception of through every pore, and then leaving the mark on the top view on the map. Mm. So being in both scales at once, that perhaps is what I would describe those people who I value and why I would, you know, do my best to leave maps.
Mm. Well, thank you for being a visionary to me in both map making and world building. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What a lovely conversation. You.